Hi, this is Suzanne Eder, and I have the honor today of speaking with Freddie Silva, the fascinating Freddie Silva. Freddie is a best-selling author and a leading researcher of alternative history, ancient knowledge, sacred sites, and the interaction between temples and consciousness. He is also the world's leading expert on crop circles. He has published 4 books, The Lost Art of Resurrection, First Templar Nation, The Divine Blueprint, and Secrets in the Fields. They have been published in 5 languages. He's also a documentary filmmaker and leads private tours to sacred sites in England, France, Egypt, Malta, Peru, Bolivia, Scotland, and Ireland. For over 15 years, he has been an international keynote speaker and appeared on the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, BBC, numerous video documentaries, and national and international radio shows. He is described by the CEO of Universal Light Expo as perhaps the best metaphysical speaker in the world right now. So welcome, Freddie. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks, Suzanne.
As you and I discussed in conversations prior to this interview, I'm fairly new to your work, and I found your first book, Secrets in the Fields, and devoured that one. I haven't yet read your others. So since that's my... that's where I'm most familiar with your work, I'll start by asking questions about the crop circles themselves. And I'm curious, you mentioned that the genuine crop circles actually stopped in 2003. So could you say more about that?
Yeah, indeed. In fact, it's usually a bit of a shock for people when you hear that. If you're still following the phenomenon, you kind of expect the whole thing to be a performance each year. And it keeps going on and on and on. But the truth is, and if you want to follow the absolute truth of what the phenomenon really is about, it's worth keeping things in perspective. And prior to when I published my book back in 2002, we had a sense that the whole thing was coming to a sort of a crescendo. We had a sort of a foreboding that it was all part of a big conversation. And just like any conversation, it has a beginning, it has an end, and it has its purpose. And in about 2003, there were 3 major designs, genuine designs, which were totally mind-blowing. And after that, it just seems that the whole world and their uncle went out and made crop circles to try and imitate the real thing. And of course, you can't imitate it, but it looks very impressive. And since then, we've really seen a major rise in hoaxing, and the phenomenon's become very, very rare. Yeah, it's as though they're sort of fine-tuning here and there. And it may also come as a surprise that most of the genuine designs are actually appearing in Ohio and also up in the Canadian prairie, of all places. And that's something that we also knew about 20 years ago through a channeler in England who actually was channeling the crop circles before we even knew what a crop circle was. And her information has been very, very useful in guiding the scientific research since then. So the truth of the matter is that the phenomenon has done its work. It's implemented what it came here to do. And it's also a commentary on our modern life where we expect things out of certain things. We expect things to perform, and we put a sell-by date on everything. And, that was so yesterday, I want now.
Yeah.
I think it's a very interesting indictment of our modern culture that we expect certain things to behave in a certain way. And, of course, these, and I'm going to say entity for now, the origin of the crop circle, they're not here to perform. They're here to fulfill a major retuning of the earth and also a major retuning of humans as well. So it's important to keep it in perspective, but it doesn't diminish the phenomenon in any way. In fact, I think it's the most important phenomenon to have occurred on the face of the earth for the last 100 years. So there you have it.
Wow. So a fine-tuning. Is that how you described it, a fine-tuning of our consciousness?
Yeah, and it was, again, I go back to this interesting woman who used to be a bank liaison officer in England, but she comes from a family of channelers. They're all very, very gifted. And her job was to basically heal people and also tune into the origin of sacred sites in England. And one day, quite by accident, she accidentally vectored this information from what they call themselves a universal consciousness, describing themselves as the Watchers and also as the Shining Ones, and that they've often come in Earth's history over several thousands of years. And if you do the homework, you can actually find them throughout the Indian texts, through the Egyptian texts, and they're all there. And they used to sort of incarnate as well from time to time. They said that basically they've realized that the human race once in a while kind of gets it wrong. we get a little bit off track. And the whole idea and the reason why they call themselves Watchers is because they don't have the right to interfere in human affairs. It's an inviolable law. In fact, many of you who are fans of Star Trek will know this as the Prime Directive.
Prime Directive,
and Gene
yes.
Gene Roddenberry was also privy to some of those channelings, and a lot of the information that he got from that universal consciousness ends up in the text that became the blueprint for the second generation, and that's why people love it.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah. If you strip the space age theme away, and
yeah.
you've got universal law, and they're going by the same rule. There are people and beings in our culture that we've come to call guardian angels, for example, in the Western tradition. And these basically are the same expression of those beings in the spirit world who say, well, humanity is going down a very dark path. The only thing we can do to help is to suggest an alternative course. And by placing these crop circles around the world, and they're actually a very old phenomenon. They're not actually new. They have been coming from time to time. But the big explosion was, of course, late in the 70s and then through the 80s and the big point in the 90s. The big point was that they were imprinting the Earth with energetic forms at strategic locations on the Earth's grid, which just happened to connect with the local sacred sites as well. And that's part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was twofold. Well, actually threefold. One was to sort of manipulate the Earth's energy field in a certain way to buy us time to get our act together. Because, the Earth does need to shift every once and again. And we are living in geologically quiet times. In fact, it's almost uncanny that nothing major seems to happen in the last few thousand years. And yet you look at the geological record and horrible catastrophes do befall the Earth every so often. So we are kind of living on borrowed time. And they also realized that in order for humans to develop into the next level of our expression, we need to be more aware of what we're doing to the planet and also to ourselves. So there is a spiritual component. And the reason why they put these symbols out was to get us to be curious. And once you're curious about symbols, you begin to inquire about the symbols, and then you realize they're packed with information. And people go off like me and decipher this stuff, and they start putting it out into the public realm. And some people get it and some won't. But that's the whole point of raising consciousness. Some people are so attached to the status quo, and some aren't. They recognize the bigger picture. And that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to influence people to see that there is a bigger thing going on here in the world, not just about humans or the Earth. There's a whole universe that reverberates to whatever we do down here and the course of action that we take. So if you can show that there's another consciousness around the universe that also is caring about the way things are, then maybe we'll stop treating the Earth like a dump ground and also sort of work better with ourselves in order to become much more enlightened. So, and you can see it's having an effect. I mean, we now give women the vote. We no longer string colored people from trees. We've given gay people the right to marry. So, things happen slowly down here. But slowly
yes.
We are beginning to wake up. And I do believe part of that is what's been imprinted on the grid. And thirdly, there's also information of a tactical nature inside the crop circles, which is also guiding certain physicists to understand the nature of matter. And I put a picture on the front cover of my book deliberately. Out of 10,000 crop circles, I picked the one that I just knew and had some background information to that would actually help some people unravel the mystery of gravity and also propel them to create a new energy device. And would you believe it? Without saying a word, the image appears to have attracted three different groups in England, in America, and in Australia, and they have built an energy device which appears to defy gravity. I can't say more about it right now because the people who are involved in that will release the information when it's politically appropriate, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So that's why I mean that when I said that the crop circles are the most important thing happening in our age, because they are here to help, not to, to push us along in our understanding, but not to change things. We have to be the change we want to see. Otherwise, there'll be no point in being here in the first place.
Exactly. Wow, that's just kind of bowled over by everything you've already said. We're just
I'll give
started.
You something to think about.
I'm glad that we're recording this so I can listen to it again. I can see why you're called the most the best metaphysical speaker in the world right now. So thank you for that. Just many different directions we could go. I know that your own work has evolved to now you've done so much research now into sacred sites, into ancient gospels, so your work continues to deepen and evolve. And before we get into that, I have a question though about the book that I read, the book Secrets in the Fields, which is about the crop circles, which you wrote back. It was published in 2002, I think.
That's right.
So you must have been writing it around, I guess, around the year 2000, 2001. So that's 15 years ago. In that book, I was just astounded by the depth and the breadth of it, and I'm curious personally. Have you always had such strong intellectual and analytical and intuitive abilities, or do you think they were enhanced by your immersion in the crop circle phenomenon?
Oh, I've been a genius since I was born.
Oh, somebody's got to be one, right?
I wish I was. I'm sort of a late bloomer, I think. No, I do believe that people or souls are incarnated with a certain mission, and some people are very lucky. They discover what their mission is pretty early on. Others have it thrust upon them later on, having gone the circuitous route of getting involved in the modern world and to a certain extent realizing how hollow the whole thing really is. But I'd never really fitted then, in hindsight. I mean, I was always into pyramids and things that people felt to be crazy because it didn't fit into the orthodox view of things. And so, I was always an outsider, and I did go into the commercial world. I was a very successful art director and writer for many years in graphics and advertising, and I didn't feel comfortable with it. And it was when the crop circles really appeared that something just turned inside me. And it really did, to the point where I can pin the demise of my career at that moment. And I'd always been interested in the different levels of reality and the fact that the story that we've been told is not it doesn't sit well.
No.
And lo and behold, the more I've researched into it, of course, the truth is that the opposite is actually quite true. So yes, in a certain manner of speaking, working with the crop circles did alter my understanding of life, the bigger picture. It did wake something up that I believe was already residing inside me, like all of us. But it also allowed me to put two and two together, which is to understand that the crop circles and sacred sites and ancient temples are all the same thing. They literally are just iterations of the same concept. And that blew my mind. And but having interacted directly with the energy of these symbols and being in the fields and living around them day in, day out, yes, it does change you. It does open you up. And I could be here on the phone talking for days about the experiences that I and many, many other people, without even realizing it, have experienced by interacting with these symbols, even just the photographs of them. It's a magical experience. I won't say it's a religious experience because it has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with spirituality.
Yeah.
And it's your connection to the grid, the Godhead, if you like, but also how important you are as a living being. And I do appreciate that once I became part of that sort of energy field, that suddenly, yes, my awareness begins to increase, my ability to see through people, even see energy physically and visually, and even be able to interact with it. I actually teach classes on how to build your own sacred site. And I watch people actually and teach them how to move energy and watch people falling over when they do. It's quite a profound thing. And I think that comes back again to the question of what the crop circles were here to do and what ancient sacred sites are here to do. And it was always about teaching you how important you are as a being, how powerful you are, and what a god you actually are, which kind of defines us from modern religion that teaches us that God is somewhere else. Well, no, God is actually inside you all the time.
Yes.
It's not a religious concept. It's a spiritual concept, which gets us into trouble all the time. So, Yeah, I do believe that the interaction has actually wakened something that was already inside me, and it really goes back to what the ancient people were saying, that it's so important to interact with the sacred places because it does awaken the great man within, as they called it, back in China in 3000 BC. I always tell people, you know, whether it's a crop circle, a Gothic cathedral, or a standing stone, go there, interact with it, because if you just leave yourself open for a little bit, what you'll find is that if you just become aware of the spirit of place, and you don't even have to believe it, just be aware of it, something will happen to you, and your life will change in ways that you will never would have imagined before, and you suddenly will realize just how powerful you really are.
Mm. You know, you made a point in that piece about that you teach how to create your own temple, right?
Yeah.
One of the questions that I've always had is, you know, do we need to go to go to special sites? Aren't we powerful enough on our own to open to the divine, to open to our own infinite wisdom? Can we create that for ourselves and within ourselves?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you just look at the one of the last avatars that came down here and tried to, you know, fix himself. A guy called Yeshua ben Yosef, better known as Jesus. And he always stated the temple of God resides within you. You know, I'm always sort of having a go at the Catholic Church, but at the same time, I'm also very aware of the teachings are very important. And he said it very well. God is not an external thing, which the Church has always tried to promote. God is an internal thing. And if you look at the history of humanity, you'll see how the Western Church has basically murdered people who did not believe in that ideal. And in fact, the Gospel of Philip actually decries the Orthodox Christian religion as a faith of fools. That's an apostle actually saying this. And when you look at it from that point of view, when you realize that everybody in that period, and going back even further, 3,000 years earlier to the Egyptians and the Chinese, they're all saying the same thing, that, you know, you are God. You're just an expression of that creative force. So you look within yourself, you put yourself in a quiet environment, and you basically connect. And they used many techniques for you to be able to connect with the center of things, and that was shamanism. You could ingest certain herbs to get you there, you know, with mixed effects. I mean, you've got to be very patient and also very careful with that kind of thing. It can actually drive you crazy. You can go to the sacred sites, which are packed with electromagnetic energy. They're packed with geomagnetic anomalies. And it's these things that science now realizes are important in trying to alter our state of perception so that we have an out-of-body experience. And when you're there, when you've crossed over into the other world, you realize just what an incredible universe you're actually inhabiting. And so that helps you to connect too. You can join secret societies and try and have the same effect today with mixed results because, you know, the information has been corrupted quite a bit, so you've got to be a little bit careful about that. But it really comes down to, you know, finding the right technique, like Kriya Yoga, for example, to try and steel yourself and put yourself in an environment where you remove your ego and find that special part within that connects to the bigger picture. And that's where the magic really happens. That's when you realize that your connection is very, very direct. Because as many esoteric people have always said, you know, the Godhead is trying to understand itself through us.
That's why
it creates things. And it makes a lot of sense, actually. You know, because it's a big mystery of life. You know, what is God? We shoot each other over this question, but we're asking the same question, looking for the same answer. It's almost like a bad Monty Python movie in a way. we're all searching for that question, and of course, the answer really is that this energy source, this divine feminine, which many people call it by that, it wants to create things in order to, so it can find out for itself what it really is. I don't think it actually knows what it is. That's the big conundrum of the universe. And it uses us, or we use it, or vice versa, to try and get a bigger understanding of the creative process. And if you can just accept that, you don't have to believe it. If you can just accept that for a second, that's a very powerful statement, because it means that you are literally the eyes of the creative source. And whatever you do, whatever you see, whatever you feel, whatever you say, all of these actions go back to the control box, and it shapes that control box, and it reorders the whole fragment of the universe. You can literally change the universe by whatever it is that you're doing. And that goes back to what so many avatars and esoteric people have said over thousands of years, that you are the reality that you wish to see. And however you behave in life, whatever you do, it affects the outcome, not just around you, but on the earth and also on many different levels. So this is the thing that's been missing from Western civilization for a long, long time. We've been brainwashed to believe that we're somehow separate from the source, and it creates no end of problems, and I believe those are coming to a head today.
Hmm. Thank you for that.
This will give you something to think about.
Well, you know, you're, plenty. And truthfully, nothing you've said, this is where I've come in my own journey to deeply know that, to understand that, to believe it. I've had a few delightful transcendent experiences, and this is part of my own journey and teaching as well, that we are not separate from God, from Source, that we are an expression of it. And so it changes everything about how we approach life.
Oh, absolutely. The trick is to sort of not to have the experience, and I think everyone ought to strive to have at least one experience in their life, because it will change you. I mean, it's changed me. I used to be an atheist until I got involved with crop circles and sacred sites. I'm being honest about this. I really was. I couldn't see how a creative, loving force could do so much harm in the world, but there's the rub, because it's not. It allows things to happen. Loving source will just allow things to happen and let people take responsibility for their actions. That is a true loving source. It places no limitations on things, and then you are accountable to yourself. And I think that's a very important thing to do. I think to ask of something or someone else to be responsible for our actions so that we don't take responsibility for what we do or exonerate us from the things that we do, I think that's led us into a blind alley. And I think we're seeing the repercussions of that all around us.
Indeed. So, I want to circle back to something you mentioned in the earlier part of our conversation that I wanted to ask you about, which is the Watchers, the Shining Ones. You've already told us a little bit about them. Are you still, as your work has evolved to be with directly with sacred sites and those ancient gospels, are you aware of their presence? Is this something that is your understanding and connection with them continuing to evolve and expand?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, even much more so. I'm much more aware of the subtleties around the whole phenomenon. I'm more aware of the subtlety of nature and independent spirits going around. Some people call them fairies, forces of nature. It's many, many terms. I do, because they basically are there to help us, and they, in so many people who are respected channelers. And by the way, we can all channel. It's just something that gets talked out of us when we're young. You know, I mean, remember if you cast back when you're younger and you remember before you were seven, how you used to talk to invisible people all the time, and your parents used to come around and smack you in the back of the head and stop talking, talking to little people. Well, it's quite true. You can see them when you're still younger. You still haven't had your ego developed. You still have a foot in both worlds. I think that's it's very important to remember those moments, because, and those moments of intuition where you suddenly take a left turn instead of a right, and the car behind you just suddenly gets hit by a truck. Or you suddenly wish, you know, I really need that parking space outside the bank, and it's right there.
Right there, yeah.
It's those little tricks, those little innocuous little moments that actually is the universe trying to communicate with you and saying, see, you can do it. Now let's try something bigger. I'm not talking about winning the lottery. That gets done all the time. I'm talking about things to sort of really help yourself in this world. And that's what it comes down to, working with subtle energy and sacred space. Mm-hmm. It's to be aware of the spirit of place, because they keep saying, you know, we in the spirit world are very envious of anyone who chooses to incarnate. It's really bloody difficult to come down here, be trapped in a limiting vessel, and not have the freedom that we do to wander around. Although we do this whenever we're asleep at 3 a.m. You know, we do travel to places way outside our physical realm, and that's when the soul does get a chance to leave, and it comes back pretty quickly. But they keep saying, you know, you keep forgetting that, you know, we understand how difficult it is, so we like being asked to help. because the whole point is that we're having also an experience through you. We want to see how you're also living in the physical world, and your choices also help shape our universe. And that's quite an important thing to remember, that we are actually responsible for other people, the outcome of other people's universes too, by our actions. So it's a two-way relationship, and if you become aware of that, life takes on a whole new meaning, because you suddenly realize that you are very supported. And something just came to me that I've been observing people who are on this path, and whether they're teachers, whether they're healers, writers, researchers, every one of them, without exception, either lives or has moved to a location, a house or an apartment or a piece of land, where they are actually on the energy lines. I'm talking to you right now from downtown Portland, Maine. I have two energy lines running right through the room on which I'm sitting in. So we're always tapped into this grid, and what we do feeds the grid, and the grid feeds back into us. It's a feedback loop. And the more you do it, just like driving a car, the better it gets. And every day you realize that you do have this sense of power. Just don't get carried away with it. You do have the sense of power, and just ask for help, and just be open to watching the symbols around you of the answers that you get. So it is important to connect with those sources. They are very loving. They come in various shapes and sizes. They manifest to you in a way that you will understand, which is why when you go, for example, to Persia, you talk about the genie, which is where we get the concept of Aladdin from. But mm-hmm. that genie is the way that the spirit of place presents itself to people in the Middle East. You wouldn't have the same expression, for example, in Japan or in Arizona. The spirit world has no physical body. It doesn't look like us. It's just energy. So in order for it to present itself to us, it feeds itself through our emotional system. So when you go to a certain place, you get a gut feeling about something. It's either right or you're wrong. And that's the spirit of place telling you something. And it's very important to be aware of those moments, because those are the intimate moments when you really are tapped in to the big group consciousness. So many of us talk about this, you know, I really want to be tapped into the group consciousness. Well, you are. You already are. You just have to be aware that it's happening every single second. And the more that you are aware of it, the more your life improves and is empowered beyond your wildest dreams.
So how do you go about finding and uncovering the secrets of these sacred sites? Do you follow in kind of a standardized process, or do you follow your own inner guidance and the guidance from the non-physical realm?
Oh, you have to keep a very wide palette, I think, because you can read everything that's put up on the bookshelf, and then after about 10 years, you go back to those books and you realize, you know, I actually kind of knew most of that stuff anyway. I just never thought about it that way. You can only intellectualize the process for so long, but the intellectual process really is to help me prove to people who are on the fence or in the skeptical field, to give them a permission to believe what I'm writing about. They need concrete answers. They need substantial proof. And that's the hard part of the work, is finding it. And it's there. You just have to work really hard at it, which is why I gave up my high-paying everyday job to do this. But the fringe benefits are so much better. But it's also an intuitive process. And the more I find, my books and my work seem to follow my own acceleration of development, and you can track it. I mean, for four books, you can actually see the development that I'm actually coming at it from a slightly different point of view each time, and it's always very refined each time. But it's me picking up the information that's actually in ancient temples, or even a standing stone or a pyramid. It's all there. In fact, I just came back from Peru a few months ago, and I went down there for the first time. I was leading a tour with somebody else. And it was uncanny how I actually knew where I was going each time. And I usually, when I take people on tours, I usually go there first to scout it out. This is an unusual situation. And the other people who were actually leading the tour, they said, it's kind of funny that you seem to know where you're going. You've never been here before. I said, I know exactly where I'm going. I don't need any help. And came back to the hotel each evening just downloading information. And I thought, my God, I am actually sitting here talking to people about the sacred sites and how they work and how the history of things, which comes from a logical background, but at the same time, I am also receiving so much information in return from whatever is there. And I go back home, I write about it, I put it on computer, I start doing the geometry and things, and you know what? It's all there. And that was an incredible experience to find sites which are still unadulterated by human impurity. So many sites now are, you know, I mean, I go to Stonehenge every year with a group, and we have to wait till everybody leaves until we get that quiet moment where we can really appreciate the site for what it really is, and then it comes alive. It's just so shut down because no one goes there to do the sacred sites for the right reasons. But if you are there for the right reason, they open up to you. And it's quite a significant experience. You really are being watched. You are being followed. And it's a wonderful feeling. It's a little strange at first, but it's actually quite quite loving. So, yeah, it answers the question. It is a wide palette. It's intellectual. It's intuitive. And it's also then part of your own understanding, which you blend together from all of these different palettes to try and create a certain vision. And again, as always, the trick is to put yourself out of the equation. Otherwise, it's just your opinion, and that's no good to anybody else. What I try to do is get as close to the truth of the people that built these places as close as I can. That's my mission in life. And that's why I'm a double earth sign. That's what I do. I want to get to the core of things. If I was a Virgo, I'd be even more annoying. you know, I'd want to be really, really so damn accurate. I just have Taurus with Capricorn. It's bad enough as it is. But that's my mission. I want to be as close as possible to get under the skin of whoever built these places for us. Because if they went to that trouble to build these places and they've lasted for thousands of years, then surely we deserve to respect them in the way in which they were intended.
Wow, yes, yes, beautifully said. So tell me about your latest book. The Lost Art of Resurrection is your latest book, correct? And it's your most recent?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely.
Or a lot about that, whatever.
It's finding a little bit of resistance at the moment. I think once you put the word resurrection in front of people, you get this knee-jerk reaction unless you're a stout Catholic. But you know what? It's actually not it's not what it is. It's not what it actually means. And it's really a progression from the Crop Circle book and through the other books. Each book is a progression of the other, and it's kind of I never actually planned it that way. It's just the way it's actually come out. And I was actually struggling for a theme for the fourth book, and then I just finished writing the book on the Templars, and they were huge on a concept called raising the dead. Now, the Templars were 1,000 years after Jesus, and you think, now, what the hell were they doing? And once I started looking back at all my notes about ancient civilizations and how they performed secret rituals, I kind of got lost in it, and suddenly the answers came pouring out of the woodwork, and suddenly the book just manifested within a couple of months. Resurrection really is a very old concept. I found its earliest reference in China in 2700 BC, by a group of monks that used to go up the sacred mountains to find the way. And the way is also called the Tao, of course. Mm-hmm. And it was essentially the underpinning of the teaching of the Essenes, with whom, of course, Jesus and John the Baptist were very intimately associated.
Yes.
And this is where the concept of living resurrection really comes from. And it was practiced in Egypt in ancient times, and it was meant for the living, not the dead. And that's a huge story. I began to research the origins of why the church back in the 4th century was killing everybody left, right, and center that disagreed with it. I thought that, okay, if you got a very solid religion based on the experience of one guy, well, why not let it stand on its own merit? Why do you have to go and destroy other people? And the one thing I found, 99% of everybody else, and I'm talking about the Sufi, the Islamic people, anyone you could care to think about, right down to the Celts and the Native Americans, they all agreed on one fundamental principle, that resurrection was meant for living people, not for the dead. And it was supposed to be experienced by initiates in this sacred ritual They took 3 years to complete this course. They were deemed to be, first of all, to be responsible people with secret information, because it was all about the manipulation of energy. And the culmination of this ritual was to be put inside a cave. After taking a small narcotic, you basically have a near-death experience. So you can imagine, this is very harrowing. I mean, who in their right minds wants to have an induced near-death experience? And they did it. I mean, people like Plato, Pythagoras, Zoroaster, all of these people were doing this. And I thought, this is quite an extraordinary thing. What was the whole benefit? And they unanimously said that the whole point of going on this out-of-body journey into the other world was to discover the source of the source and also the purpose of your soul. And they would come back into the living body, not having been crucified, because the crucifixion never even took place. And again, even the Quran agrees on this, along with the Gnostic Christians that were all murdered by the church. The crucifixion was a symbol. It wasn't supposed to be taken literally, and neither was the resurrection. It was all a metaphorical expression of a spiritual ritual. So anybody that confuses the resurrection of Christ with an actual event is confusing this with a spiritual ritual. And that's what they all agreed on. And I thought, what a great story, because ultimately why these people did it was because they said it's the pinnacle of a person's spiritual development. And I thought, now that's worth dying for and coming back into the body. And it was very serious. I mean, they had priests who looked after you, and priestesses as well. It was open to women as well. In fact, the Zoroastrian tradition, which was part of this living resurrection ritual tradition back in, 2000 BC, they're still practicing and admitting women today. In fact, there was just an article in the paper the other day about it. So it was an all-inclusive spiritual practice. And it was very self-empowering, and this is why everybody was against the Catholic Church and fundamental Christianity, because it differed so vastly from the teachings of Jesus, which is much more self-empowering. It goes back to what I was saying about the Church of God resides within you, and they were absolutely true. So that's what the book really essentially is about. It's about the misconception of resurrection, where the origin really comes from, how empowering a ritual it really is, and also about the places around the world where you can still perform it to a certain degree, obviously. Very difficult to do it by yourself, but if you do have the mental training, there are places around the world where you can just disappear into these caves and these special man-made chambers. And if you're not disturbed, you can spend a good night in there and come back pretty much enlightened. One of the places where people tend to go to do this, after paying a lot of money, of course, is the Great Pyramid. And that's why people are either spooked or highly provoked spiritually when they go into the King's Chamber. That is one of those chambers where they did perform the resurrection ceremony in there. And, of course, the presiding person of that building is Osiris, who happens to be the original blueprint for the story of Jesus. So now we know.
And have you experienced that yourself?
I did, actually, and in a very weird manner. I wasn't looking for it. And in fact, I didn't even know about this at the time. I was actually looking into the origin of sacred space and the whole purpose of why temples were built in the grand scale around the world. And that formed the basis of my second book. I was there with a group of people, actually, ironically, with the woman who was channeling the crop circles originally, our glorious spiritual fearless leader. We'd just gone to the sacred sites in Egypt to do a little bit of what we call spiritual terrorism. In other words, we go around quietly fixing the things that people break in temples by quietly, you know, using meditation and focused intent to rebuild the energy field of these sites, to try and clean the rubbish that people leave behind, because these places remember everything. And if you go in there with your negativity, it soaks it up too. So we go and fix things quietly. And I'd gone into the Great Pyramid with four guys and two women. And if you've been in there, you know what a cacophony it is. It's just people running up and down for a few hours, all very excited, taking photographs. And we got into the King's Chamber, the six of us, and everybody left the building. And I thought, you know, you have to pay people thousands of dollars to experience this intense, quiet feeling. And the two women with us left. They felt very uncomfortable there. They felt great in the next pyramid, and there's a reason for that too. Each temple had its own frequency. So it's four guys. The lights then go off, so we're in complete darkness in the king's chamber, and it's the most wonderful feeling. And again, we weren't looking for an experience. We just went there to do our work. And we thought, okay, well, let's quietly do a little bit of toning in here while we have the experience of being in the building by ourselves in peace and quiet. Let's do the work that we've been taught to do. And we began to tone in the king's chamber in total darkness. And I can see about 33 people coming out of the stones of the king's chamber, dressed in a beautiful white satin, circling around us. Remember, this is total darkness, and I can see these people clearly as daylight. And to cut a very long story short, we then, after that experience subsided, we took turns lying in the sarcophagus for about 10 minutes each. We weren't going to push our luck. And I can tell you, in 10 minutes, I have traveled into places which I can't even begin to tell you, and it was the most wonderful, liberating experience to realize that you're actually tapped into a sort of a wormhole. And I'm still trying to process the information. I think that part of that actually comes through in my writing. I'm pretty sure of it because that's my purpose. And but it was. You really do connect with another level of reality in those boxes. And years later, when I began to write the Resurrection book, I actually went back to my library and picked up a book about a guy who also had a similar experience in that chamber. And I hadn't read it. It's been sitting there for 10 years. Paul Brunton wrote about his experience back in the 20s, and he also saw exactly the same people coming out of the stones of the King's Chamber, had exactly the same experience, was transported into another reality, except he had actually had the entire night in the building. Back then you could do that. So it just shows you the power of these places, and given the right circumstances, you can actually have that out-of-body, other-world experience. You do come back, literally, risen from the dead, which is that, and the meaning behind the phrase is quite simple. The initiates who experienced this spiritual liberation, they were declared risen, because compared to ordinary people who go around everyday life with their cell phones glued to the television, they're so unaware of what's going on in the bigger picture that they were described even back then as the dead. And that's where the term comes from. So, yeah, in a matter of speaking, I was risen from the dead in that experience where I really wasn't looking for it. And I've had many more since then. It's like I said, the fringe benefits to operating with sacred space are quite wonderful.
I'm aware of a very strong energy coursing right now as you're speaking. It's wonderful. There are a lot of accounts now of out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, even without being in a temple. And there is that consistent experience of, wow, finally knowing who we really are and bringing
exactly.
that awareness back into it.
It's actually interesting reading the accounts of medical people who've had recent near-death experiences, and that they begin to describe the same processes that that we do. And initiates back in 3000 BC were describing, even the Greeks with Plato and his description of his own experience, they're describing things in exactly the same way. And now they've taken an interest in all this metaphysical work, and suddenly the medical profession is having to grudgingly accept that the people before us were right. So things happen glacially here on Earth with humans. It's just the way it is, you know.
It is awfully glacial, though.
Yeah, a friend of mine had a very good phrase for it. It said, it's just humans being.
Just humans being, yeah. So obviously you're traveling to these sites regularly and year-round. When you're living at home day in, day out, do you have special practices that you do?
I drink heavily.
Okay, that worked.
actually, it does help to ground me a lot. I mean, you have to find your technique. Some people eat a lot of meat to ground them. You can sort of lose track of your faculties if you don't ground yourself regularly. But I live on two energy lines. I've got a lovely view of the ocean. I'm very lucky in that respect. And I have probably the cheapest rent in Portland, Maine as well. I think my work grounds me as well. It gives me my ability to sort of connect with things. And I just can't wait to sort of get people back out onto the sites. In fact, I'm about to take another group there in a few weeks to the sacred sites of southern Britain. And then I'm going to go to the Yucatan as well. That's how I recharge my batteries. I come here to get some work done, get grounded, take care of mundane things. And, you know, a month later, I'm back out again. It's the way that I recharge myself. But I do know that I can't be away from these sites for too long. It becomes a bit of a drug. I mean, my parents don't really understand me at all. And people who look at my holiday slides, it's 1,000 pictures of standing stones. You know, and I keep saying, you know, but you know what? I've taken thousands of photographs of these things. And I'm a professional photographer by training. But that's not the point. The point is that they never bore me. Each stone is individual. It's like I'm actually addressing an actual animate being. And it's funny that when you go to these places, and especially the sites that are least visited, that they do behave like animate beings, and you do have these intimate relationships with them. And you won't understand that until you've been to these sites and you spend time with them, and they become your best friends. I mean, it's kind of funny to say, isn't it? You know, my best friends are standing stones. But they really are. I mean, they guide you, they protect you. They've never let me down. They always seem to be there when I need things. And it's reassuring. And I think that's the reason why they put them there and they made them big in order to last into our lifetime. I think that the architects realized that we would lose something during the course of our evolution, which brings us back to crop circles again. You know, they have to keep reminding us of our connection. So to have these big stones standing up in the middle of a field, it really is a powerful experience. But again, being there makes all the difference, and it does change your life in ways you'll never imagine. And I always tell people when they get to these sites, whether with me or by themselves, you know, if you like the way your life is now, don't bother coming, because chances are it's going to change you 180 degrees.
Yeah.
And it may really alter you in a way that it will make you uncomfortable at the beginning, because you know we all like our comforts around us. We like things to be normal. But the fringe benefits are always wonderful, because the whole point of being here, and I can quote the Apostle Philip on this, is that you know, the whole point is for you to, if you could discover the purpose of your soul, then you are basically the master of the world. And that's an incredible statement by an apostle who has really said some really horrible things about the church, and his gospel was banned, but it's all in there. It's one of the best gospels worth reading, but he was absolutely right. If you can discover the purpose of your soul while you're alive, you are literally the master of the world.
Wow, that is incredibly powerful. And this Gospel of Philip, how did you discover that?
It was part of the Nag Hammadi text that was discovered in 1947, and the church spent millions making sure the information would not come out. They suppressed it even more. They should know by now that when you put a parental sticker on anything, people go out and buy it.
Of course.
It's like the Da Vinci Code. You know, I used to be Dan Brown's neighbor in New Hampshire, funnily enough. We were the two struggling writers walking up and down the beach. Of course, he's sold more copies than I have. The irony being that he uses material that I write in order to create his fictional books, which then bounces back to people like me, which is great, you know. And they spent a fortune debunking his book. Well, it's a fictional book. It's based on certain facts, yes, but it's still a fictional book. So why not just leave things where they are? So the same thing happened with the Gospel of Philip and most of the Nag Hammadi texts, because they actually show that there were writings before the official Gospels that clearly show that there was an esoteric tradition to Jesus' ministry. But more importantly, that the ministry of Jesus was actually not that important. It was John the Baptist's ministry, which is why the church went after the Templars, because they were following the church of John the Baptist. In fact, the Mandeans, who were the predecessors, actually, I'd say forerunners and also contemporaries to the Essenes, still worship to this day the book of John the Baptist, which the church says doesn't exist. Well, if it doesn't exist, why do they worship the book? So there's all of these. It's like a bad movie. You know, the more they deny things, the more they come out. So the Gospel of Philip can now be bought anywhere in any bookstore. I believe Inner Traditions actually translated a copy, and they've actually published a version of it. And it's wonderful. I quote it a lot in my book on the Art of Resurrection, because it is worth quoting, because it's so damning of this idea that the church has built up, that somehow everything is separate from, that you are separate from God. And he was saying it the exact opposite. And there's a lot of other interesting things, like the Gospel of the Great Seth. That's also part of the Nag Hammadi texts. And there were some academics that have written wonderful works about it. And if I knew their names right now, I'd peel them off, but I can't. And they too have, in the last decade, helped us gain a bigger understanding of what really was going on back in that time of Jesus, and why so many people were opposed to the Orthodox Church. And now we know the truth, because they had a better understanding of the ritual process of initiation and resurrection, and the church misused that information to create a, what Philip described as a false church. In fact, there's one gospel, and I believe it's the Gospel of Seth, that has a direct quote from Jesus watching his own crucifixion. Think about that for a second. Okay, Jesus is watching his own crucifixion. He's saying, it wasn't I who drank the vinegar and the gall, it was another, and it was another who carried the cross, it was Simon. And the Quran says the same thing. You know, it was Simon of Cyrene that bore the cross. They didn't crucify Jesus. They mistook an actual event with a spiritual truth. So there you have it. So yeah, do go out and buy a copy, because it's a wonderful reading.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. So my my normal linguistic faculties have been shut down.
Well, don't do that. It does make you think. I mean, it's the hardest thing to try and talk about these things is that, you know, we've been raised with 2,000 years of a certain doctrine. And it's not about right or wrong. It's about, even the truth. I mean, everybody has their version of the truth. But once you've been indoctrinated in a certain way of thinking, it's so hard to suddenly take in something that seems to contradict that point of view. And that's the thing that we all face when we're inquiring. But when you start inquiring about things, you have two things happen. One, the truth that we've been told by various official agencies stands up to scrutiny, or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, we need to change our way of thinking. And I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about trying to remove your ego from the equation. It's amazing how liberating it is to say, you know what, I was wrong about that. And I've done it in my lifetime several times, when I thought I knew everything about crop circles. And then one day I realized, actually, I don't know everything. There's new information that now comes up that wants me to reevaluate a certain aspect of it. So let's do that, because by doing that, we get closer to the actual truth of what actually is going on. And this is where the paradox is in today's world. Once we stick to a certain version of the truth and don't allow new information to come into your life, that only makes the problem even worse for you. This enfranchises you from the situation. You have to be aware that we don't know everything. None of us know everything. Each one of us has a version of the truth and a version of the facts. And the more you allow the facts to permeate you, the more the closer to the truth you will get. And I think that's a very good way of going through life, to be open to the possibility that there's another story, and an even better story. And I was just talking to my new publisher about this, because they're about to re-release these, The Lost Art of Resurrection, in about a year. We were talking about how, you know, I'm not trying to bring down a faith with this book. I'm trying to show that actually the story of Jesus is actually much more interesting than we will ever believe, and much more self-empowering, because you don't want to take people, make them look like they were following a false religion, which they have been, but don't make them look like fools. Everybody should believe in something if it makes them happy, and let them. What I'm trying to do is just say, well, look, there's now information, evidence that shows that the story is much better and more self-empowering than we've been led to believe, and that can only do you a lot of good. So be open to it in whatever way, shape, or form that will take you. There'll be bumps along the way, but that's why we're here on Earth, to have bumps. Otherwise, we would stay in the spiritual world and look down upon us and go, oh, Earth, that looks hard. That's going to hurt when you go down there.
So, for anyway, one of the questions that I've pondered on my journey is there seems to be agreement among those of us who are inclined toward a spiritual perspective and have read and researched and meditated and have had these experiences that there has been a forgetting of who we are. We've forgotten who we are.
Oh, totally.
And we've created this illusion of separateness from source. Is the forgetting part of the overall experience, or is it kind of, in essence, a mistake?
No, yes, it is, because, and this is said again and again and again in all kinds of esoteric texts and philosophical texts, channeling, everybody's been saying about this. In fact, there's a clinical psychologist called Michael Newton, who wrote two of the best books on taking people into regression therapy. and finding out what actually is happening to them. And he inadvertently tapped into them going into the other world and talking to them as souls. And this is a clinical psychologist. He's not into woo-woo. He's not into New Age at all. And they all agree on the same thing, that when you agree, your soul agrees to come into this physical world, part of the thing that you do is to forget where you've come from. And here's the paradox. You spend your entire life trying to remember how to get back there, how to connect with the spirit world so you can live your life more consciously. It's because this also goes taps into the Star Trek thing and to how Gene Roddenberry phrased all the episodes of that series using universal law. And it was all really to do with the fact that you're here to have an experience. So if you really remember why you came down here and why and the trials and tribulations you're about to go through, I guarantee you 9 out of 10 people would not bother incarnating if you knew how damn difficult and how painful it is to be here. Try being in love and then falling out of it. That should convince anybody not to come here. And I'm seeing that with a grin on my face as well. So you come here to forget in order to relearn, but also remember those as you go through life, and I wish you'd know this when you're younger, it comes in so much more useful. As you look back on life, you realize that certain things and certain people that you met, it's like you sort of knew them.
Yes.
Certain places that you go to resonate with you, and why should they? You've never been there. If I go to New Mexico, I feel totally at home. I've never been there, but I feel totally at home, as if I belong. And yet it's a desert. There's nothing there. There's something about your genetic makeup when you inherit a certain body that carries the DNA and the memory of other people within your soul family, and you attach yourself to that in order to have that experience. So it's not about a right or wrong situation. You come here, you forget, and then you live out that experience, and slowly as you go through life, you are reminded here and there of your purpose. And someone taught me something very important about this. We talk about Earth as being a planet of choice and a planet of free will, and possibly the only place in the universe where this happens. To a certain degree, that is apparently true. But you don't have unlimited choice. If you think about it logically, if you had unlimited choice, you'd never get anything done. It would make Geminis impossible to be with. They would have so much unlimited choice of anything, they would never be able to decide what to do. So it turns out there are only three paths you can take, three choices you can make in life. You have your main path, and if you're really lucky, that's the path you follow through all the way to the end. There is a second path, which is when you get distracted by something that takes you out of your main path. There's a shiny car, that lovely, attractive woman or that attractive man, and then you realize pretty soon that that's not actually what you wanted. That's what your ego wanted, and that relationship will fall apart. And then the soul world will remind you again, would you like to go back to path A, or do you want path C? And that is a limitation that is imposed on the soul down here on Earth, so that you try to remember what you came here to do. Otherwise, you'd be so distracted, you'd never get anything done. And I thought that was a wonderful way to look at it, a wonderful teaching. Again, to remind you of those moments in time where your life falls apart, and to look at those moments and recognize for what it is. It's your soul conspiring with the spirit world back in the source to say, okay, my life has just fallen apart. I've lost everything. What is the purpose? And the purpose is to remind you of what makes you really happy.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've been there, Suzanne. I mean, you've sort of changed courses in your life at your job, as most of us have, because something fundamentally didn't fit.
And
that's, of course, if you're not following that joy within you, then you're not living that path. And that path may be difficult, but at least if you're joyful, you know you're following it. And I think that's the best advice I've ever been given, because it feels really true.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. So much the details of what you're saying are just incredible, and many of which I haven't heard. The basic message, though, was one that I have felt, believed, and known for many years now. And yet, in this conversation with you, again, the energy is just so strong, and I'm really just appreciative of this conversation opening me to a deeper level of understanding. It's just
oh, good. I hope they don't bill you too much by the telephone company. That was a serious conversation. It was full of too much information. We have to charge you double. You know how it is. It'd be quite funny, wouldn't it? If you'd be charged by the gigabyte, by depending on the level and of quality of information that you're receiving from one end of the phone to the other.
Let's not suggest that, okay?
Yeah, I mean, there's a screenplay in there somewhere.
There is. I love it. There is indeed. One final question. What question have you never been asked that you would love to answer?
I don't know. One thing I keep getting asked is, do you use your special powers to win the lottery? And you will not believe. It goes back to the limitations of the soul world. That is one question I do get asked a lot, and it's, you know, the powers are not so special. We all have these powers, but it's the inverse of what you're asking, but I'll say it because it's so funny. Yes, we have used the ability to connect with the grid to tune in and find out what the winning number of the lottery is. So far, we have succeeded in losing $156 million every single time that we guess the numbers, and it's quite regular. Something happens that it prevents us from actually buying the damn ticket, and then the next day, we check the numbers. Unbelievable. Because, you know, some of us come down here to get rich quick, and some of us have to earn it the other way, you know, by really toiling and troubling over things. And it's just the way it is, you know. But they're just reminding you. The universe has a very, I'm English, I can say this, a very cunning sense of humor. They're real bastards. They really like to play some good jokes upon you, and that's one of the best ones. You know, suddenly you use your intuitive ability to get rich. Well, if it's part of your plan, why not? I mean, you know, unless you sort of come from a self-flagellating sort of ultra-Catholic Jewish tradition, there's nothing wrong with being rich, you know. It's just an energy. It's just a bunch of figures and stuck on a piece of green rectangle with lots of numbers at the end. There's nothing wrong with money per se, but if you didn't come here to be that way, if you come here to earn your money in another manner, no power that you are given will allow you to actually win the lottery. And again, it just shows you the limitations that are imposed in the creative process for you to have this experience. But I can say, hand on heart, that every time I've sort of tried to do something which I think is for my highest interests, and later, of course, it turns out it's for my ego's interests, and you learn as you go along, you know, you fine-tune, that every time I go somewhere like San Francisco and I figured, you know, I really would like to live here. It's the kind of city I really adore. It reminds me of Europe. It has a wonderful openness about it. Getting a date for a straight guy is not a problem. And I figured I'd really like a nice apartment on top of Pacific Heights. You know, why not? And I'm going to play the lottery because I need, obviously, $3,000 a month just to live there.
Live there, yeah.
And I always win the lottery every single time I go to San Francisco. And you know what? I always win $10. So it just shows you. I'm just not meant to be there. I'm meant to be somebody else.
Wow. And speaking of money, though, is it true? I think you're saying it is true for you, and it's true for our path. And whatever we're meant to be, that main path that we're meant to be on, we will be supported.
They don't actually understand. The one thing you got to understand about the spirit world is, and this is a thing that they find complex about us too as well, they don't have a physical body. The whole difference between inner body and the spirit world and why the spirit world wants to be incarnate was the experience, the full-fledged of a spectrum of emotion that comes with having an emotional system and a nervous system. And, of course, they don't have that. So when we're getting fretting at the end of the month when, you know, how the hell am I going to pay for my rent and my car and this, that, and the other, they're saying, well, what are they so worried about? It'll just happen. You know, don't worry, be happy. But they don't understand that we also have something that they don't have, which is called time. Plus money is a material thing here on Earth. They have no concept. And believe me, they take you right down to the wire. Somehow it just seems to work. I go through this every single month. I don't know, 1st of August, I don't know how I'm going to get through the month, but you know what? Somehow it just seems to work. I don't even question it anymore because you just worry about it too much. Just let it be. Just do what makes you happy. You know, don't live up in the clouds all the time. You know, you got to have one foot in the ground. I mean, a lot of people where they go wrong with the New Age world and the esoteric teachings is, if I read about all of this, I'm going to be so super trippy hippie. And everything's going to be provided for me. It doesn't work that way. You have to be proactive, which is why so many people get it wrong. there is no God, there is no spirit world because this didn't happen. Well, it probably didn't happen because it's not really in your best interests. But if you keep pushing it, it will happen, and then you realize pretty soon you shouldn't have asked for it, because sometimes getting what you asked for is not a good thing, as many people listening will probably agree with. You know, that was not the guy or the woman I really should have married, you know, after all of that. You have to remember that things happen in their own course. And again, you have to be proactive. You have to follow that path of that inner sort of happiness that comes with what you're doing. And things will take on their course. As the spirit world keeps saying, don't worry, be happy, which I believe became a very interesting song as well. So I guess they're also listening to the songs that we listen to.
Well, I wish we could talk for hours, because my mind is now brimming with more questions, but we're over an hour, and I just want to thank you again for your time, your wisdom, your generosity. What a pleasure. And I know that everyone listening will be expanded greatly. And please get the book, The Lost Art of Resurrection. Please get the book. Is there a website that you want we can direct people to?
The one that encompasses everything that I do is at invisibletemple.com.
Invisible, there we go. Yes, I had it. I had this link pulled up. Yes, so it's invisibletemple.com, and you can find the book on that site. Freddie, thank you again. This has been such a pleasure. I can't wait to read the book.
Well, thank you very much, Suzanne.
All right, take care.